This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Today I'm interviewing one of the most venerable members, I think it's fair to say, of Jodrell Bank Observatory, Professor Sir Francis Graham-Smith. Thank you for doing another interview, the Jodcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So you've been in the game of radio astronomy for a long time, but I thought, as we usually do, that I'd start about talking about your current research, and you've been working for a long time on the pulsar in the Crab Nebula. So could you tell us a little bit about what you work on with that?
That's turned out to be a long story. There is a paper on the timing of the Crab pulsar. Now, this pulsar produces pulses at the rate of about 30 per second, and it's slowing down. You can actually measure the amount of slowing down during a day, but it gets more interesting when you ask, is it slowing down at the same rate over a long period of time? Now, we started watching this pulsar about 45 years ago, and about 30 odd years ago we started really quite accurate timing of it, but putting together some of the early observations, we now have a very good sequence of observations lasting 45 years, and during that time we reckon that we haven't missed a pulse.
Wow.
You only have to watch it every day, and you can then sort of join up from one day to the next. But during that time, billions of pulses have gone by, and we can tell you the whole history of the rotation, which is quite an exciting story.
It's a fairly extraordinary pulsar, isn't it? Because it's, by pulsar standards, it's very, very young, and you've been observing it for 5% of its lifetime.
About that, yes. It blew up nearly 1,000 years ago. We're watching quite a substantial part of its lifetime, which is pretty unusual in astronomy. What we have to decide is what is happening in this process of slowing down. The main process is from the fact that it's a very, very powerful magnet. And like the rotor in a standard power generator providing power for the grid, when this magnet rotates rapidly, it radiates and it loses energy at that rate of 30 hertz, 30 cycles a second. It's intriguing to think that the rotor in a power generator is going round at the same sort of speed as this object. But the object itself is a star, a very, very condensed star. It's got the same sort of mass as the Sun, but it's only about 20 kilometres across, about the size of a large town. So it's very, very dense, very strong magnetic field. Now that's the simple part of the story, that it's rotating by radiating magnetic energy. Every now and then it does what we call a glitch, which means that it speeds up a little bit and its slowdown rate then changes. We don't know exactly why, but we've been tracing these glitches all the way through, and we think we've got a coherent story as to how it slows down, which is partly due to the magnetic radiation and maybe partly because it's spewing out particles as well. Well, and the particles go out into the nebula surrounding it. Now, the nebula is the remains of the supernova explosion, which went off in the year 1054, and it seemed to be expanding, and it's also radiating. The energy for the radiation comes from the pulsar. The nebula, in fact, was the first object which was detected to have strong radio emission without us knowing that there was a pulsar inside. And it was one of the objects that I measured in my early days as a student to measure its accurate position to make sure it really was identified as a radio source coinciding with the nebula.
But was there a mystery as to why there was so much emission coming out of it?
Yes. It turned out that it had X-ray emission as well. And the process of emitting from this hot nebula was so efficient that it should have lost practically all its energy in about 10 years. And yet there it was, continuing as an X-ray source. And it's actually used as a kind of a standard X-ray source rather than one that's decaying. So it was obvious that there must be some source of energy. And that indeed is the pulsar.
Wow. When you came into it, radio astronomy was still a very young discipline. When the Second World War occurred, you were still at that time, I guess, finishing school?
Yeah, certainly I was at school. I got to university by great good fortune and did a 2-year course, which was all one did during wartime years, and ended up in 1943, still during the war, going to the Radar Research Establishment, Malvern, known then as Telecommunications Research, TRE, working on radar. I was in the measurements section, measurements and test gear, so I learnt a bit about techniques for high-frequency radio, as we called it then. I constructed things like wave meters and became interested in measurements generally. At the end of the war, I got back to university, to Cambridge. By that time, I knew Martin Ryle, who had also worked on radar. He worked all through the war and worked on countermeasures. He was a very adventurous, experimentally inclined physicist. And when he got to Cambridge, he started investigating some observations which had been made during the war. First of all, of radio emitted by the sun, and then I got involved in that quite soon. Later on, we together started working on other sources of radio, which happened to include the Crab Nebula, although we didn't know it when we started.
So he was interested in astronomy?
Not particularly. It was some time before we actually called ourselves astronomers at all. We had to learn everything from scratch. When I was measuring accurate positions, I just had to learn spherical astronomy from scratch. I didn't know any of the textbooks. I didn't know about a chap called Bessel, who a century before had worked out in detail what happened to what are called now transit instruments. Sometimes a transit instrument is not quite aligned east-west, and the one I had was about 5 degrees off east-west, so I had to work out what happened when you had a transit instrument which was at a cockeyed angle. And I did that. Before that, I didn't understand astronomy, I didn't understand spherical trigonometry, so I had a lot of fun as a student. One picks things up rather faster when one's young.
Well, what you were developing at Cambridge was the technique that we call interferometry, which is now how all the future radio telescopes really work, by linking up many dishes together rather than just using one.
That's right. We started, of course, with two dishes, which was really rather like Michelson way back in the 19th century measuring the diameter of the brightest, largest stars by using two mirrors feeding into one telescope, which was the 100-inch Hooker telescope on Mount Wilson. And he and his experimenter colleague Pease managed to measure the diameter by using these two mirrors. If they're further apart than the diameter of your telescope, then you have a chance measuring the diameter of the object you're looking at. In my case, it was a question, first of all, of measuring the position using the two telescopes as a transit, and there you're measuring everything in relation to a line on the surface of the Earth. And then later on, I managed to adapt it to measuring diameters, and I measured the diameter of the Cygnus radio source and the one in Cassiopeia. I was lucky because the interferometer spacing between the two dishes was just right for that, as it turned out. There are other people, particularly in Australia and at Jodrell Bank, who were developing techniques for measuring diameters, and they guessed that the diameter would be smaller. So they were developing techniques to put their dishes further apart and connect them by radio links. Turned out it wasn't necessary. I was lucky and I could do it by connecting them by cable.
One thing that you'd mentioned to me in a previous conversation, which I'd never heard about before, was that actually in Australia they did some interferometry experiments that managed to use just a single dish, but they were actually using a natural reflection of the radio source.
Yes. The analogy of that in optics is Lloyd's mirror, and some people who did a physics course might know about Lloyd's mirror. But what happened there, there was radar developed in Australia in parallel with the radar work in England, and what they were concerned was coastal warning of aircraft approaching. So on the high cliffs at the entrance to Sydney Harbour, they installed a radar. And when they were looking towards the horizon, the dish, well, it was not a dish, it was an array of dipoles. It picked up signals, direct reflection from the aircraft, and also indirectly reflected from the sea. And these two signals, collected by the same antenna, they showed an interference pattern. They interfered with one another, so that as the height of the aircraft above the sea changed, so the signal changed. Now, you can look on that that in another way and say they were using two antennas, one of which was actually there on top of the cliff, and the other one was the reflection in the sea, which would be a couple of hundred feet down below the surface of the water. At any rate, that gave them an interferometer, which they used in the same way. They were able to measure positions and diameters. They worked, for example, on the emission from sunspots, and they showed, as we did in Cambridge, the radio emission from the sun, when it was very active, came from above the spots and not from the whole disk. They went further and they investigated the newly discovered point source in Cygnus and then found some others and got approximate positions for those, which they actually correctly identified, even though the positions were a bit rough. And those were the objects which I worked on in Cambridge and gave the accurate positions, which really secured the identifications.
Some of these turned out to be incredibly distant objects.
Yeah, they were an incredible variety of things. The first one to be clearly identified was the Crab Nibbler itself. It was in the constellation of Taurus, so it was called Taurus A, and then quite soon became known as the Crab Nibula. Some years later, it was found that this condensed object in it, pulsar. So that was one object that's in our galaxy. The next one to be discovered was Cygnus A, which actually had been the first point source to turn up during some wartime work. That turned out to be in a bit of sky which had got a number of galaxies in it. It wasn't obvious what it was. Crab Nebula is very conspicuous. But eventually it was pinned down to a very odd-looking galaxy. The astronomers in California, Mount Wilson and Palomar, got onto it and measured the spectrum and found that it was indeed a very odd galaxy with quite a large redshift, not large by modern standards, but put it as a distant galaxy, way away from our own galaxy. And then in Australia, there were two other galaxies which clearly something odd, one in Centaurus and one in Virgo. So there was a wide stretch of things. We added to that Cassiopeia A, which was the visible, scarcely visible, but radio prominent, remains of another supernova explosion, where you couldn't see anything in the middle of it, but you could work out how fast it was expanding, and you could work out that it was less than 300 years old. Nobody had actually seen it as, or probably nobody had seen it as an optical observation, but there it was, two supernovae remains in our galaxy, and three extragalactic objects. Which way was it going to go? Well, you have to build some bigger radio telescopes to find out.
I'm quite interested in the quasars, because now we would say, well, we measure their redshift, so how far their radiation has been shifted down the spectrum, and we say that's because the universe is expanding, and therefore that we think we know how far away it is. But at the time, that wasn't obvious, and there was quite an argument going on about whether redshift really was caused by an expanding universe, and so this sort of helped contribute to that debate.
Yeah, it was very difficult to grasp what was happening, because not many of us understood anything about cosmology. If you think back to that time, we'd got Hubble's observations. Comparatively nearby galaxies were actually receding from us, most of them, not all of them. And he showed that the further away they were, the faster they were moving away from us. So we had the idea of the expanding universe. But how far you could possibly see, what was really the history of the beginning of the universe, what was going to happen, how much of the universe was actually there, you know, what is the average density, none of that was really understood. So when the quasars turned up, and those came from observations at Jodrell Bank of sources which had been catalogued at Cambridge, but no one at Cambridge was measuring diameters. The people at Jodrell, that's Henry Palmer mainly, were measuring diameters by getting an interferometer and putting the dishes further and further apart. One of the dishes, of course, was the big Mark I, called the Lovell now, and the other dish was portable, taken further and further away to see if you could actually measure the diameter. And by the time they'd got over into Yorkshire and were connecting the dishes together by radio link, they were able to show that the diameters were extremely small, certainly much less than a degree, much less than a minute of arc, and had to be measured in seconds of arc or less. Now that was really exciting, and again there was an appeal to the Californian astronomers. Had they got spectra of these objects, and could they tell us what sort of objects they were. Well, they did get spectra, and for a time they couldn't even interpret the spectra because the redshifts were so large they couldn't even recognize the pattern of spectral lines that they were measuring. Well, eventually the penny dropped, and there were large redshifts, which were called in terms of Z redshift, Z equals 0.5 or thereabouts, which is not large by modern standards, but then it was absolutely astounding. So the quasars showed that we could see to very great distances in the universe, and then it got exciting because there was already a catalogue of some hundreds of radio sources, and you could say, gosh, are these really very distant? Are they distributed uniformly through the universe? Can you check that the universe is expanding and so forth? And Martin Ryle at Cambridge gave the Halley lecture, and everybody really sat up because he had got the statistics of these first few hundred galaxies. We know now a lot more about those statistics, and it looks elementary at the time. That was the first indication, though, that you could actually do some real cosmology with the radio galaxies, radio sources.
Wow. That brings me on to an interesting point about how people's understanding comes to change over time. So with quasars being distant galaxies, and also with pulsars, although much closer, being these sort of almost unimaginably dense objects. Is it something where at the time you sort of have to hang your hat on one theory or the other and say, I believe this, or is there a lot of skepticism that lasts for a long time before people are willing to accept what these crazy ideas?
Well, there's a whole range of answers to that. If you look to modern times in cosmology and you look at the satellites which have been designed to measure the structure of the cosmic microwave background, that's another story, but you know that the sky is uniformly covered with the remains of the Big Bang. Very weak but uniform signal. Only way of investigating if there's any structure in this is to send up a satellite, and there have been a sequence of them called COBE, WMAP and Planck, and they're measuring the very faint structure in this. What scales are the structure? Now, the extraordinary thing there is that theorists had really got going on cosmology by then, and they predicted the cosmic microwave background should have structure in it at the level of about 1/1000th of its brightness, and that it should have a structure predominantly about 1 degree in scale. It would also have structure at 1/2 degree, 1/4 degree, and so on. And blow me now, when the observations were made, they fitted precisely to this pattern. The only thing that was slightly uncertain, whether the scale would be right, and even the scale was dead right, which proved some theories, some patterns of cosmology must exactly fit the bill and others didn't. That was the beginning of precision cosmology. But not only precision, but it was predicted. Now you go to the opposite end of the scale and you look at the discovery of pulsars. That was completely baffling because nobody had expected any pulsating signal to come out of the sky, and the Cambridge astronomers who were first onto it and said, I wonder if this is some man-made object in the sky. No, that didn't work. Is it some extraterrestrial civilization sending pulses? All sorts of ideas like this before it was really decided that it must be neutron stars, and that was on the basis of observations actually of the Crab pulsar, which we talked about earlier.
Fantastic. Well, you were at Cambridge, and then later on you came to Jodrell Bank, and that was sort of covered in the previous interview that you did. But I'm quite interested in how you first came to meet Sir Bernard Lovell, who was the first director of the observatory, and then eventually how you became the second director.
Yes. How did I first meet Bernard Lovell? Don't remember, actually, but of course there were two groups at Jodrell Bank and at Cambridge, both working after the war, and both Bernard and Martin had been deeply involved in radar research for the whole of the war, which I hadn't been. And so they knew one another well. There was good liaison, as well as, of course, a healthy competition between the two. And the subjects that were worked on were sort of complementary. In fact, Jodrell's main big job was getting radar echoes from meteor trails, which Cambridge wasn't involved in at all, so that we were able to collaborate somewhat at a distance. The first real collaboration, I believe, was when we both parties were interested in what happened in the ionosphere. That's the ionized upper parts of the atmosphere, because signals from these distant radio objects had to come through the ionosphere, and they got diffracted, scattered, so that there was a kind of a variation, a twinkling of the radio signals. Now, we wanted to know what scale that was on the surface of the Earth. And so one way of doing that is to get quite separate observations going simultaneously at places which had to be some tens of kilometers apart. Well, what better than to observe simultaneously at Jodrell and at Cambridge? Hmm. And that's actually the first time that I got involved in working at Jodrell, because we had some really good observations of that extragalactic object, as it turned out, Cygnus A, at the two places. And we showed that the scintillations were very different at the two places, which gave us the first indications of the scale of the fluctuations, the structure in the ionosphere. Then, of course, later on came a question of what was I going to do? I'd been working on research fellowships and so on at Cambridge until I was the advanced age of 40. I hadn't had, if you like, a proper job. Bernard Lovell came to me and said, would I like to work at Jodrell? And so my first job here was as a professor, which was rather a rapid leap. And I haven't looked back since.
Right. At some point, but you were the Astronomer Royal for a time. So how on earth did that come about?
Well, that was a different phase of my life, because after I'd been here 10 years, the question of the future of optical astronomy in the UK came up. Now, optical astronomy had been languishing because England is not a good country to observe from, generally. I mean, you can do quite a bit, but the idea in those days was to build some really big expensive telescopes, and it didn't seem a good idea to build those in England. Let's build one overseas, a lot of people were saying. And some said, that's no good, just leave it to America. Others said, let's look around and see if there is a good site in Europe which we could develop, possibly in collaboration with other countries. So during my last year or so at Jodrell, there were teams going out, organized by Royal Observatory Edinburgh, to explore sites in, as it turned out, Madeira, the Canary Islands, and Hawaii, and also a little bit in Spain, Calo Alto. And the comparative results of those were coming in, but no decision had been made. So the head of the Research Council, Sam Edwards, who was a professor in Manchester, came to me one day and said, would I like to be the head of the Royal Greenwich Observatory and build an observatory overseas? Huh. Well, I was a little taken aback. It took me about a millisecond to answer, saying it seems an interesting idea. So that's what happened, and I spent 7 years in optical astronomy, was able to make the decision to go to La Palma and oversee the building of the first telescopes there. And that's now, of course, a major European, largely European observatory. So I was director of RGO, and I was running this place, and it's interesting that historically the director of the RGO had been the Astronomer Royal, but I wasn't the Astronomer Royal then. Uh-huh. I was given that later as a kind of a reward.
Okay. Well, there's one event that's not particularly related to astronomy, but I was quite interested in it because I saw a photo that was kept by one of the secretaries here at Jodrell for a long time, and it was all about a TV programme, which I remember when I was quite young. It was called Treasure Hunt, and there was a presenter called Annika Rice who would sort of fly about in a helicopter.
Oh, I remember.
And had to do treasure hunts. And this amazing picture was her with the helicopter here at Jodrell, and you were in the photo as well.
Yes.
So that really happened.
It did indeed. I remember the occasion vividly. We had a small dish, part of the visitor centre at the time, and it was used by the public, but of course it had to have a fence around it. You couldn't have people climbing on it. Now, Annika Rice was supposed to flip around the countryside, picking up clues as to where to go next. And one of the clues was attached to this telescope, and it told her to go to, I think it was Tatton Park. So she knew she had to get to the telescope, and so she was dashing around and encountered this fence and had to get over it. So I said, okay, I'll help you over, and I made her back, and she jumped on it and got over. And it was hilariously funny, actually, the whole thing. She got to Tatton Park, Park, and there was Reg Lascelles, who used to run the visitor centre. And Reg said to her, "How did you get on at Jodrell?" "Oh, fine," she said. "There was this little old man who helped me over."
You didn't reveal.
No, she didn't know who I was at all.
Did it all end up on television? Well, that's wonderful. Amazing photo. Well, that's great. To bring it full circle, I thought I'd ask you, what has been your favourite bit of research or your favourite development that you've been involved in during your career?
I think the accurate positions of the four radio sources, which I did entirely myself, you know, most things you do in collaboration, but the positions of the four objects involved observations over more than a year, and I used to observe these four objects every day, which involved actually going out to the two dishes and jacking them up to the right elevation, setting the recorders going. So four times a day and night for the whole of a year was quite an effort. And that I did myself, and it's always satisfying to do something by yourself.
Yes. Mm-hmm. How was the data recorded at that time?
Oh, on miles of paper. The techniques were crude. Well, it wasn't crude. It was the best available. The time was set by accurate clocks like those used at Greenwich. In fact, one was borrowed from Greenwich, known as a short clock, one of the slave pendulum things. That was my source of time. I developed a way of checking that against the recorded time signals. We're working to about 10 milliseconds, I should think, you know, an enormous long time by modern standards. But then I had to measure the transit times on the paper. I just had to keep up with this through a year. It was a pretty strange occupation when you come to think of it.
But it does sort of seem as though the means of combining the signals, you say, to 10 milliseconds, was actually very sophisticated. It was just that the means of storing the data or manipulating it once it was output wasn't there because we didn't have computers.
No computers at all. No, nothing digital was involved at all.
So when you said you had reams of data, it was literally reams of paper.
Yes, rolls of paper, which we preserved for quite a long time in case it might be valuable.
Were you also involved in creating or maintaining the instruments themselves?
Oh, yes. After the war, there was quite a lot of wartime equipment, but there wasn't any really good low-noise amplifier available, so I spent quite a lot of time fiddling around with vacuum triode valves, which was the best we had for low-noise amplifiers. I could tell you quite a bit about developing those as low-noise amplifiers. Low-noise meant, you know, a noise temperature of about 400 degrees K, whereas 1 degree K is reckoned to be quite good now.
There was no cooling of the receivers.
No. If you cooled a vacuum tube, it probably wouldn't work.
It's just really interesting because it's like you now, I suppose, most astronomers expect the instrument to be there for them and it's somebody else's job to sort of put it together, but you were kind of being astronomer, engineer and technician all the time.
That's right. That sort of interest stayed with me. That's really why I'm still writing. I'm writing a book at the moment on telescopes, and that means telescopes all the way through radio, infrared, ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma ray and so forth, trying to show the sort of unifying themes between all these. And I find myself at least as interested in the techniques which go into those as in the astronomy, which gets opened up each time you have a new look at the sky.
Well, in that case, it's probably a good thing just to finish off by mentioning your book, which came at the end of 2013, which is Unseen Cosmos.
Oh, yes.
And that's sort of an accessible book, not a textbook, but it's an accessible book for anybody about radio astronomy.
Well, it is about radio. I find myself quite often having conversations of the sort that we've just had. And so I thought I would write an account right from the beginning, not to the end, because there's no end to it, but getting up as far as the proposals for the square kilometre array and such like exotic radio telescopes. The telescope book will also end up with SKA, I think, but it has to start way back with Galileo, and it has to keep mentioning other wave bands as well. It's going to be quite difficult to keep it under control.
It's amazing where it opened up in the 20th century from optical astronomy out to the whole spectrum that we look at now. And indeed, with pulsars are a great example because they emit something, at least one pulsar, for almost every telescope that we've got.
Yeah, the Crab Nebula was known for a long time as being the most interesting object. Somebody once said, I think it was Thomas Gold, saying there are two kinds of astronomy, the Crab Nebula and there's the rest. And it isn't quite as extreme now, because cosmology has taken over. But nevertheless, the crab pulsar in particular is really, I think, the most exciting single object in the whole sky.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for all of those reminiscences and current research.